What's up, guys? Welcome to the Behind the Deal podcast, where we explore growth through acquisition. Whether you're a private equity fund manager looking to expand your portfolio or a business owner aiming to scale and build lasting value through acquisition, each of our episodes will break down the strategies, stories, the lessons that make acquisition one of the most powerful paths to growth. I hope you enjoy. What's going on, guys? On today's episode of Behind the Deal, I have the privilege of talking to Mark Ute of Clarion Capital. Mark and I dive into the background and history of private equity, where it started, why it started, who started it. A lot of fascinating stuff, honestly. Reasons why, reasons that I never even would have thought of are huge contributors to why this industry even came to be. And then we get into how it's evolved over the years, where it went, and then where it's going, where it is today and where it's going in the future. I think Mark is incredibly insightful. There's no one better out there to kind of give this backstory. So I was blessed to have him on the show and learn a thing or two from him and, get to learn a little bit about how a company like Clarion positions themselves and, why they've been able to be so successful. So enjoy this episode. I think there's a lot to learn. What's going on, Mark? Good to see you. Welcome to the Deal Gen Behind the Deal podcast.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to see you also.
Appreciate your time, man. Well, look, I know we talked a little bit about it before the show, but a lot of the episodes I do might focus on a specific fund's thesis. They might focus on specific acquisitions a fund has recently made, kind of go into the background stories of, failures or success stories. But for this particular episode, I figured because of, your history in the space and knowledge of the space and kind of its transformation, we could talk a little bit about, the backstory of private equity, kind of, when it first got started, how it's transformed, and, maybe some of the things that you're seeing today.
Great.
So I guess my first question to kick it off, talk to me a little bit about when, private equity kind of first emerged. What unmet need or inefficiency was it trying to address? And, who are some of maybe the early players that, kind of set the model?
Well, the origin of private equity, of leveraged buyouts, is really in the tax code of the late 1960s, early 1970s. Ordinary income was taxed at 70% versus 30 to 35% for long-term capital gains. And the 70% marginal tax rate was significant enough that owners accumulated cash inside of corporations rather than, paying out dividends. As an aside, almost all corporations were C corporations at the time. LLCs did not exist until later in the 1980s. And some Chapter S corporations were not popular because the marginal tax rate into the early 1960s was 90%. And therefore, people did not want the income of the corporation flowing to them personally to be taxed at that high rate. In any case, the 35% difference in tax rates created a tax arbitrage, where a buyer could use the cash to bootstrap themselves into an acquisition and put less money up. So a buyer of your company could borrow the money in his acquisition vehicle, merge it into your company, and thereby use your own cash to help them buy the company. The proceeds you received for your shares were capital gains and therefore taxable at 35%, not the 70% you had to pay if you paid out a dividend directly. And therefore paid the cash out. So that was really the origin. And really the deals into the 1970s up through the mid 80s were extremely small. The original players were people like Holbrook, Kravis, and Roberts, and the different members of Gibbons, Green, and Rice. Joe Rice went on to become Clayton and Dubilier. Green went on to become first Gibbons, Green, Van Amerongen, and then Leonard Green Partners. So there were a handful of early pioneers.
Got it. So that's interesting that you're saying, a lot of this evolved from, basic tax strategy versus, the maybe EBITDA arbitrage type of game that people started playing later, or was that going on then too?
Well, I think when you go back to the late 60s, early 1970s, this was very much a growth stock market. So things were very accounting-based and public markets-based, and there was probably an underappreciation for the value of cash flow. And so the early leveraged buyout people really understood that earnings didn't translate into cash, weren't worth as much. And sure. earnings that really converted to cash, you know, were actually worth a lot. So there was a disconnect. And that disconnect was still there in the 1980s when I got to Drexel.
Got it. And so at that time, you know, had there, talk to me about maybe some of the shifts that had happened that, you know, kind of made private equity, I guess, evolve from maybe a niche strategy that some people were playing for, you know, a decade or so to more of a mainstream kind of institutional asset class where, you know, a number of different investors and, you know, I guess high level institutions are trying to put capital into, you know, people are actually out there raising funds now.
So really, until the mid 1980s, these deals were extremely small. Like the average deal in 1981 was only $40 million. So we're talking about very small deals. And to this point, the market really only had wealthy individuals as investors. The market itself really was not available to institutional investors, particularly the large ones that are public pension plans today. Because it wasn't until the late 1970s that the ERISA rules were first passed. And then in 1979, they were clarified to allow investments in private equity under the prudent man standard. Before that, trustees were way too scared to put money into private equity. So that made it okay to do. But the buyout boom really started with a deal. So in 1982, Bill Simon and Ray Chambers, a firm called Westray, put up around $1 million to buy Gibson Greeting for around $80 million. And 16 months later, they completed an IPO for close to $300 million.
Wow.
This caught everyone's attention, yeah. And the boom began. So at that point, you had a lot of people begin to rush into leverage buyouts because they saw the capability to make excess returns.
Got it. And so at that time, I guess, you know, after that deal, the leverage buyout strategy was born. And that's when, you know, funds were popping up. And like you mentioned, with some of those, you know, laws and regulations that were passed, more people were able to put capital into private equity. And so was there a kind of onslaught or, you know, kind of mass adoption, or did it happen, you know, over time?
So I think in the, we mentioned 1979 when the rules changed. So early in the 1980s, the first public pension plan started to come in.
Yep.
And as recently as, or as late as the late 1980s, you really only had Washington and Oregon, the state pensions, as really the only institutional money. They were early people in KKR. For instance,
sure.
The second thing that happened in the mid-1980s is the financing of buyouts completely changed. So a combination of returns coming in, a little bit of institutional capital, at the beginning evolution of capital markets led to the capability to do larger deals and many more deals to be done.
Got it. And so at what point, you know, these guys are doing leverage buyouts, these investors are, you know, now able to, like these more institutions, these state-run pensions are able to invest equity. I'm assuming they were putting equity into the deals. At what point were banks, you know, and then getting involved and with the leverage in adopting the strategy of like, hey, we'll lend, you know, to this asset class and allow them to, and I guess at this time too, you know, what was kind of the ratio of equity and debt that were going into these deals? I mean, as a fairly newer strategy, I'm assuming that people were a little risk averse, but I might be off there.
You just might have that completely opposite.
Oh, wow.
Which is the multiples of cash flow that the deals were being bought at allowed people to finance a large portion of the purchase price. And lenders were not as concerned with the percentage of equity. They were just concerned with what's the multiple of cash flow that I'm financing down to. And if you were paying six, but I was willing to loan you 4.5, you wouldn't care that it was only 25% equity. You'd go the 4.5 was fine. So as what you found in the mid-1980s, and this is when I first got involved in the early mid-1980s, the first buyout that I worked on was actually, I was on the other side of the table. I was selling a media company called Wilmetco Enterprises Wilmetco Industries to KKR. And I watched them put together a deal. And there was a bank group, and there was an SNL group, savings and loan group, and there was an insurance company group. And because there was no liquidity, right? They made these loans, there was no one to buy it. Everybody, all the documentation was very dense and very difficult. And it was just frightening to watch people put together these deals. It was terrible. And so when we closed this deal, I went back, and at the time I was an associate at Drexel. I went back to my boss at the time, who was Leon Black, and I said, wow, this is just terrible. Shouldn't we be able to do a much better job? And we called out to Beverly Hills, where Milken and his associates were located. And we said, so here's the economics of the deal, and here's how they put it together. Can't we do something better? And Mike and his team went, yeah, we can do much better than that, selling bonds to institutional buyers. And we went back to KKR and said, there's a better way. And that was really the beginning of syndicated bond deals as a way to finance buyouts.
Interesting. I mean, so it sounds like you kind of almost pioneered that in a way, and by going back, having that realization, watching this unfold, watching, all these groups getting involved and again, being a little afraid of it in a way, and then, addressing the idea that like, hey, there's gotta be a better way. And I'm sure that foresight into how to do it a better way then started to take more of an adoption, right? Someone sets the precedent, and then other groups start to look at that and say, hey, not only can we do it that way, but we can continue to do it a better way. And it leads into, again, more and more people coming up with this, unique financing and ways to do these leveraged buyouts.
And the depth of the market was much larger. So when you were going to the bond market, all of a sudden you could do larger deals than had been done till that point. So I think that opened it up. And then you saw going through into the late 80s, you saw the deal sizes begin to increase dramatically. And until you hit the sort of pinnacle of the 1980s boom, which was the buyout of RJR Nabisco, and which showed the largest deal at the time. It's a $25 to $30 billion deal. I was the working partner on it. And you could see that the depth of the market was much greater than anyone had anticipated.
Wow.
Up until 1988, what you saw was a market characterized by excess return for the risk you were taking. That goes back to the fact that the world was looking at reported earnings and not looking at cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all knew that. I don't think we all appreciated just how nice it was to operate in a market where you were getting more than compensated for the risk you were taking. I hope everybody in their career has a chance to be in that market at least once. It's a lot more fun. But so what you saw was, because of that, the returns from those early vintages, particularly the publicly disclosed ones for the Washingtons and Oregons of this world, brought a lot of institutional money into the marketplace. As people saw them as peers, said, they're making great returns, I need to get in on this. And that led in the late 80s and the early 90s to an influx of institutional capital.
Got it. Cool. So now, at this point, the asset class is ripping, right? It's there's a lot of money going into it. People are proving out strategies. I'm sure, people are continuing to adapt and new groups are popping up, and everyone wants to get their money into this in some way, shape, or form. At what point, or I guess what maybe had caused kind of the first test, right? Was it, you know, a cycle change, a crisis, maybe macro pressures that kind of tested private equity, you know, and gave it kind of its first, like, maybe scare as a potential asset class, you know? Talk to me a little bit about that.
So I think the first inkling that there could be some issues were really on the deals done in the very late 80s, the RJRs of this world, where you saw prices begin to be bid up to bid out away the excess return. And when Drexel folded at the very beginning of 1990, the high yield market collapsed with it. Mm-hmm. So your ability to refinance debt and the cost of doing so went up dramatically. And so it was in that time period that you began to see perhaps the deals that were least well conceived, perhaps highly levered, or those two things were not identical, and or not the same deals necessarily.
Sure.
And you began to see deals have some problems and at least a little bit of a pause as everyone stopped to say, what is it we did well and where did we take excess risk?
Got it. So it wasn't necessarily like a bubble, like the housing crisis or anything like that popped. You know, it was more of people started to, money started to go into this space. A lot of people started using this as a strategy. People got a little bit over their skis, in the way they constructed deals. And then some of these opportunities that maybe once looked like, amazing opportunities turned into, a little bit of a disaster and opened people's eyes to, all right, well, there could be a negative side to this model if it's not done the right way.
I think, private equity, for the most part, has always been based on operating businesses with defined cash flow. And so you could pay too much for it. You could misunderwrite how well that company would compete and therefore what would happen with its cash flows, for instance, in a recession. You really weren't financing asset value per se. And I think it was only in the early 2000s in the internet bubble that you began to see some large private equity firms take risks that looked a little bit more like venture capital on steroids than underwriting capital. But even that was not, it affected a few large funds. It never systemically affected the market as a whole.
Got it. Yeah, no. And I mean, even today, it's funny, like you look at the different strategies that some funds deploy, right? And if you're maybe a software investor or an AI investor today, and even if you're more of a private equity investor than a venture investor, a lot of these groups are underwriting to recurring revenue, and not even really factoring in the EBITDA. So, some of these groups are getting multiples, of 5, 10, 15, 20x recurring revenue. And on an EBITDA multiple, that might be out of control, right? And so some people would look at that and be like, the risk there just doesn't make much sense for me. You have to grow this thing tremendously to get any value out of it. And so that type of thing, I guess, in the early 2000s was with the dot-com boom and that bubble was starting to present itself a little bit more. People taking outsized risk, or not even outsized risk, but maybe making bets that otherwise in the past hadn't made any sense.
Yes, I would say that the software multiples that are paid, we can have a spirited discussion as to whether or not they're too high or not. But generally, they're real businesses. And that's a big distinction between the early 2000s and the first internet boom. Many of those things were not real businesses. I don't see a lot of money in AI from private equity funds. It's really a venture bet. And I think if you see private equity funds going into AI bets, you should scratch your head, because there will be winners, and the winners might really make a lot of money, but there are going to be a lot of losers. So that doesn't make much sense to me. I do think that when you look at software, the question really is, do people really know how to underwrite that and invest well in it? And I might add, we don't really invest in software per se. So this is, I can say this objectively, we don't do it.
Yep.
Software businesses can have incredible margins attached to them. Because once you've invested in developing it, then the next sale is just about the cost of sale. There's nothing you need to manufacture in order to do it. So many software businesses have incredible gross margins, like 80%, right?
Yep.
Then the question is really twofold. One, how sticky is it? People get confused and think just because it's software, it's sticky. It's not, if you can swap it out for something else.
Something better.
Yeah. And people miss that, although I think the best software investors do not miss that.
Yep.
And then the second question is, what's the organic growth rate? Of the business itself, because if you have 80% gross margins, you are growing at 30% or 40% or 50%, and you're going to buy down that multiple pretty quickly, even if you start out at 20 times. So I don't believe that it's necessarily irresponsible if you're really good at understanding which are the businesses that are going to grow and which are the businesses where there's a very high cost to switching.
Definitely. Definitely. No, I agree. I agree. And I was almost pointing out sometimes, you know, I'll talk to people because I spend a lot of my time interacting with different funds who have different strategies. And some of them obviously have had tremendous success in the software space and they completely get what they're doing and they know how to grow these things. They know how to get a return on their capital and kind of make everybody happy. And there are outside groups looking in who maybe they're not even looking in, maybe they have no desire to look in, but they might not understand how someone can pay, you know, what some of these other groups are paying. And that could be the only reason sometimes they shy away from it. But again, it all just comes down to, you know, your personal knowledge and, you know, how you associate that to risk, right? If you know what you're doing, then, you know, the risk is less than if you don't really truly understand the space. So that all makes sense. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, today, right? In my point of view, the space has only gotten more competitive. You know, there's so many, not only private equity funds out there who have raised funds, there are a lot of independent sponsors out there who are putting together deals on a deal by deal basis. There are a lot of search funds out there who are, you know, backed by people to buy, you know, maybe their first business as an operator. There's so many different strategies getting deployed. There are secondaries funds, there are growth equity funds. It seems like, you know, there's more competition than ever. I guess with that intense competition, you know, kind of at the scale it's at right now, what differentiates or elevates kind of top performing PE funds today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've put your finger on something very important, that the overall returns of the asset class, private equity as a whole, is very much going to be driven by liquidity, by supply and demand. And there is an awful lot of money still flowing into private equity. Mm-hmm. There are new vehicles, be them ETFs or other secondary funds. By the way, I'm told by managers who I know that isn't people reallocating from their main private equity into secondaries, that it's often new money into the marketplace. So all of that is driving up prices and therefore driving down returns for the market as a whole. So there's not much any of us can do about that.
Sure.
So the question is, where does alpha come from? That's going to set the beta, but where does alpha come from? And that's where it gets pretty interesting, because we once worked with our largest investor and we got all the data to look at the dispersion of returns based on the size of the funds or the size of the deals. And what you see is it looks like a funnel on its side, where the widest part of the funnel is for the smallest deals, and the most narrow part of the funnel is for the largest deals. And what it really shows is that as the deals and funds get larger, the returns converge fairly dramatically. And when you see an outlier, it's almost never above the line. It's usually below the line. Mm. But that makes a lot of sense, because the larger firms are all pretty good competitors. And it's very hard for KKR to have an advantage against Apollo, against TPG, against Carlyle. Everybody's pretty smart. It turns out everybody's pretty hardworking, and everybody is resourced, not just financially, but in every other way in terms of operating expertise, So it's really hard for one guy to have an advantage against the other. So that makes perfect sense. So where does alpha really come from? Well, as you get smaller, the average rate of return goes up a little bit. I don't know if it goes up enough to just compensate on average for the volatility, because the volatility goes up a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you are in the top quartile of the lower middle market, that's the opening of the funnel. It's pretty wide.
Sure.
And the top quartile, therefore, can do much, much better. And so the question is, what brings people into the top quartile? And that's where it's useful to think of what creates an efficient market. And there are really two things. One, which you pointed out, is the number of competitors. And it turns out there's a lot of competitors. No shortage of competitors. But the second thing is, how good is the information they're competing about, right? Sure. Where they're using IP. Going back to those large companies, they all have years of audits and strategic plans and budgets, and they have CFOs and chief human resource. They have completely foreign management teams. There's tons of information about their markets. It's very hard to have an informational advantage in those larger deals. Now you go down to the lower part of the middle market, and we get a book. You know, I won't pick on Jefferies or Harris Williams or something, but you know, the book they're sending out to 150 of their closest friends. And the book has nothing in it. An awful lot of those companies, it turns out, have never really had a real audit from a Big Four, let alone have done a real budget, let alone have done a long-range plan. And so they lean on their investment banker to help them put together the, you know, projections. And therefore, they're gibberish. And so you get this book, has nothing in it. You submit an LOI, therefore based on nothing. And they take the 150 people that they mailed the book to, and they pick like 10 to 12, and they go into the second round. And then you get a data room. Now, that can have some good information in it. You get invited to management presentation. You get a dinner the night before. So a couple hours with management, social. Then you get the management presentation, 4 hours, very tightly scripted. You get to ask a few questions. And then from that point forward, the investment banker wants you to funnel all the questions through them.
Right.
So that makes sense if it's a big company with perfect information about it. But at the lower end of the middle market, you're basically getting married. You're going to spend, you know, the next 5 years day-to-day working with these people. You don't really know who you're marrying. You don't have a fully of great information. So when we at Clarion go to buy something, we have to build our own projections based on our analysis of the market and their competitiveness in the market, and then our view of what their cost structure is or could be. By the way, overlaid with all the investments we need to make the company institutional, which usually depress earnings. And out of that will come our set of projections that we want to price on. And those could be very different than the other 5 to 10 people who are doing the exact same exercise. And in there is the inefficiency where you can gain alpha.
Got it. Really good answer. I appreciate that. Looking ahead, you know, as someone, you know, who's actively managing, you know, fund, running a fund, you know, teeing up or maybe leading the acquisitions, where do you see the greatest white space, right, for private equity? And maybe at the same time, what are some of the key risks that could constrain the upside into the future?
So there are environments where it's a great environment to make money. And then there are going to be environments where it's sort of hard to make money.
Sure.
And that can be because of the pricing in the marketplace, or it can be because of the some of the commercial or economic uncertainty. We're probably in the latter market. Mm. So looking forward to the next 5 years, there aren't a ton of deals getting done. So it's hard to know where pricing really is. If you have a very good company, you are still getting a good price for it. Might not be 20 times anymore. It might be 15 to 17 times, but still a pretty darn good price.
Yep.
If you have an even little flaw, the price drops off pretty dramatically. And I will say that when you look at the marketplace, therefore, there's a disconnect between buyers' expectations, what they should pay, and sellers' expectations of what they should get.
Right.
And this has been going on for a while, so there hasn't been a lot of trades. So depending upon where it shakes out, it will, question is who capitulates, right? Will buyers just go, well, we have all this money, we got to spend it? Or will sellers, who are getting a lot of pressure from their limited partners to give them back money, just go, well, we're just going to have to meet the market? Our impression is that way too many private equity firms have their portfolios marked at prices that are not easily realizable in the marketplace they're in. So we believe that the capitulation eventually will be based on the folk, you know, be on the part of the folks who are selling, yep, not on the part of the people who are buying. And that leads to a sort of interesting dynamic, which is once it shakes out, then the question is, okay, if what we do for a living is pricing risk, right? How do you analyze it, evaluate it, and then price it? So we're trying to create what we would refer to as an asymmetric risk reward in our favor. If I do that over and over again, not every deal will work, but I'll have a very good fund.
Yep.
And, you know, I might add that, you know, for Clarin, that's worked out quite well. I'm not allowed to give returns or anything on public broadcasts, mm-hmm, podcasts, but if you go to HEC Dow Jones, you'd see the firm is top 1%. Mm-hmm. What you find is that, therefore, how do you handicap the risk part? And that's where this is a tough environment. Because every day we all wake up and we don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen geopolitically. We don't know what's going to happen in terms of tariffs. They're on one day, off the next, 50%, 20%, 100%. And what you're seeing is that even if your companies don't import something directly, so you may not have a direct impact from tariffs, you do business. Your companies do business with people who do have direct impacts. And those companies are just frozen.
Yeah.
We have a large Korean conglomerate that's a big customer of a couple of our companies. They're digital companies, so we have no supply chain, right? But these large Korean companies with Korean potential tariffs, or they're zooming and they're down and then they're up and then they're down, they're just frozen. They, yeah, don't know what to do. So you're seeing the second order impacts roll through. So that's a hard environment to handicap because there's no certainty as to where this is all going to shake out.
Absolutely. No, I mean, the stock market goes up and down, you know, 10 to 15% sometimes based on a tweet. So how do you, how do you forecast that? You, like you said, you wake up every day, there's, you don't really know where it's going to go. And I've actually heard, you know, probably almost 2 years ago at this point, it was the beginning of 2024, I went to a seminar and they were discussing what you were just talking about, where, you know, really the only assets that are trading among these PE funds are the, you know, A+ ones, right? The really good ones that are still getting those high multiples, or the ones that they've kind of written off, you know, like the D's and the F's and all the, mm-hmm, you know, the B's and the C's and the B+'s and even the A-minuses, they're kind of holding on to and managing, and they don't really know how to move them. The other, you know, the folks that might buy them don't really know how to price them and buy them. And there's got to be a certain point where, like you said, the LPs and the lenders come knocking and they're like, hey, we kind of need some of this money back. We need a return here. We need to see something happen. And that still hasn't seemed to fully happen at all yet. And this is 2 years later, you know?
In this market, it's going to have to come from the LPs. Mm. The credit markets are actually, given all the uncertainty, are actually overheated. Mm-hmm. So a ton of liquidity has flown into the broadly syndicated loan market. There haven't been a lot of large deals. We have one, Electronic Arts, EA. But therefore, mm-hmm, there hasn't been a lot of supply. And therefore, for an uncertain environment, credit spreads are actually the narrowest they've been in like 20 years. So credit is not going to, what's going to bring everybody, bring the reality into line with people's staying power. So I think it's going to have to come from the limited partners who need to say to their funds, to their firm, the firms who are managing their funds, that look, just market to market and give us our money back. So far, they complain, but they're not really forcing people to do it.
Right, right. Do you see that happening?
No one
really knows. Yeah, yeah.
Should happen. They want their money back. They're having to do things like sell positions in a secondary. Some people are borrowing money against their positions. All of those are things that sort of bridge you. But eventually, they want the liquidity.
Right, right, right. Well, look, Mark, I mean, this has been super informative. You know, I really appreciate you kind of coming on here, not only given the history, but, you know, you just your take on everything too. You're a super knowledgeable guy. And, I think for anybody out there that wanted to learn a little bit about, you know, the history of the space and what's going on today and, you know, why certain things are the way they are, you did a great job of articulating that. So I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Absolutely. Well, you take care. And we'll talk soon. And I'm looking forward to staying in touch with you and, you know, continuing to get these valuable insights.
Great. Thanks.